Emperor Tales of the Frozen South by CWB. This podfic has a mature rating. No archive warnings apply. Summary. At the bottom of the world, two intrepid explorers make their way in the harshest of environments. An important journey must be taken, and prophecies fulfilled, but not before family meddling, political interference, and self-doubt threaten to alter the future of an entire species. Chapter 1. Tetaenga, the Arrival. Early August. It's cramped. It used to be cozy, but now it's cramped, and everything in him is waking up and screaming to get out. He works at it, randomly at first, and then with determination and vigor. And when the first crack allows dim, cool air to drift in, he is shocked, then curious, then hellbent. The noises outside are getting louder, soft murmurs becoming distinct sources. He will never again experience the silence of the last 64 days. He doesn't know it yet, but what he hears now, wet lolling, dry sweeping, slick sliding, will be the sounds of the rest of his life. There's a small hole now, and the sounds are louder, his focus more acute. It is easier to get the work done, to dismantle this prison. He has complete disregard for the protection it has provided. He knows not what awaits. It doesn't matter. He can't stay here. Now he is free, and for the first time he becomes aware of the self that exists outside his mind. It is weak, unsteady, clumsy. He finds this objectionable, but then his annoyance is replaced with indignation, because something is touching him now, and why? The it, he comes to understand, is another like him. Of course, he realizes, he is begotten. This is his father who grooms him now, bending low, tucking a slick black head under his scrawny wing to right him, prop him, test him. He must move a bit now. He must learn to hold himself, because unmoving is unsafe. It is too cold to go far, so he stays tucked under his father, and he watches. His wet feathers dry against the pouch flap's warmth, and he is light silver-gray all over, puffed up with dense down. He has a white mask that covers his face, chin, neck, and ears, and his black eyes are centered near his short black bill. It is cold and dark, but he has no concept that it could be anything but. He shakes, fluffs, preens, stretches. Body organized, he makes moves to see beyond his keeper, but his father will not allow them to be separated. He must brood at the elder's feet for the next 1.5 lunar cycles. He protests, a squawk with little bite but plenty of attitude, and then he is nuzzled. He is not bothered by this. He peers around his father's hip, under a wing extended, and he experiences something peculiar, a sensation that the world is filling in around him, becoming whole instead of the other way around, instead of him arriving in it. His reflections are of a collective nature. There are many like him, and more still coming, working their way out, joining this place. Each scene is identical, one tall, coveting one small, both surrounded by fragments of something previously essential. The larger scene surrounding these dyads is a little more varied, but not by much. He inventories concepts yet unnamed. White, gray, black, blue, cold, ice, snow, water, clan, united, gender, divided, young, cherished. He is called Sherlock, and he is an emperor. September equinox. Hundreds hatch and the colony grows. Some of the fathers take great pains to come with their hatchlings on their feet and pay their respects. His father, Seeger, Sherlock learns, is important, and his favor is sought even when none is necessary. They praise Sherlock, compliment his fine markings, the crispness of his white neckband and his fine black head cap. They note the nobility of the slant of his bill, the graceful length of his wings. Seeger thanks them and extends his best wishes for their own offspring, none of whom Sherlock finds interesting in any way. The mothers come back from the sea and save the hatchlings from imminent starvation by regurgitating krill and cephalopod down their eager necks. And when those first needs are met, the mothers create a second, new need, to be touched and rubbed and fawned over. Sherlock allows just a bit of the cooing and snuggling, as even his feigned indifference isn't that thick, and Olive wraps her beautiful black neck around his short, stubby one and promises him magnificence, blesses him with strength of heart. Sherlock presses the side of his face to her breast and gestures toward Brother Mycroft with the tip of his wing. She nods. At 7 winters old, his brother already has a place on the council. Brother's life will be significant in other ways, he understands. Political, understated power. His own, Olive impresses upon him, will be another matter altogether. Loud, influential, the evolving heart of the colony. His brow furrows above his pursed bill. How could she know that? In turn, she kicks at the shards of the shell under her feet, flips the larger pieces over, glances at him to see if he's following her gaze. The shell is run through on the underside, marked with veins and spots of the most subtle color variations. She interprets them now, for they tell the story of his future. She speaks of a long path and of trust and love. In time, he will be able to read these stories about others too, but he will not need shards of eggshell to do so. He will know them in the actions of his clan, in the stance they take at the edge of a floe, the depth of their dives, the height of their leaps. For now, though, he repeats his mother's words in his head over and over until he is sleepy from the exertion and the warmth of her pouch. When he sleeps that night, he dreams of a long path, but does not see where it starts or ends. Soon after his mother's return, the colony gathers in front of the council for the first night of the spring equinox conference. The chicks gather at the front, a bubbly sea of gray and black, their parents behind them, one eye on the offspring, the other on order. Sherlock avoids the rambunctiousness of his peers to study the assembled elders. 7 adults, 4 male and 3 female, standing at attention, a shared wingspan between each of them. They make for a handsome arrangement with their height and broad whiteness, the vibrant orange of their chest puffs, mandible markings, and crowns. He knows only a few of them by name now. By the end of the 3-night conference, he will know their names and roles, and, if he is lucky, their stories. Lyra, the peacekeeper, Erebus, the hunter, Cetus, the healer, Mycroft, the planner, Pavo, the teacher, Vela, the storyteller, and Seeger, the leader. They stand in silent formation and wait for the colony to settle. In less than a minute, 1,000 pairs of eyes face forward, and the meeting begins. This first evening is for the chicks, and they learn what to expect the next few months as their parents take turns foraging and feeding. They're told to stay close to the adults until it is time to form the creche, and they are given only one rule: never leave the colony for any reason whatsoever until after the summer fledge. Housekeeping taken care of, Pavo moves forward and gives them a brief geography lesson. They reside on Podeba Island in the Mawson Sea on the eastern side of the Shackleton Ice Shelf, on the eastern edge of the landmass known now as Antarctica, in the South Indian Ocean, at the bottom of the world. She tells them who they are and who they are not. They are Aptenodides forsteri, emperor penguins. They are not, it is made clear, King, Chinstrap, Gentoo, or Adelie. They are the largest penguins in the world, the fastest swimmers, the deepest divers, and the only ones able to mate and hatch on the ice in the depths of winter. They are survivors. Notes from the author. Carly Ann and I have researched emperor penguins so that I could write their behaviors and lifestyle accurately, but I have taken quite a few artistic liberties in the process. I will be factual where I can, and will explain where I have taken artistic license in the endnotes wherever necessary. To read more about emperor penguins, go to National Geographic, Penguins World, and Cool Antarctica. I am basing the emperor language on Maori, an Eastern Polynesian language spoken by the indigenous peoples of New Zealand. Many of the names in this story are based on constellations seen in the Southern Hemisphere. Names from this chapter. Lyra, a small constellation visible in the Southern Hemisphere, low in the northern sky during the winter months. Erebus, the second largest and most southerly volcano on Antarctica. Cetus, a constellation located in the region of the sky that contains other water-related constellations, such as Aquarius, Pisces, and Eridanus. Also, sea monster in Greek mythology. Pavo, a constellation in the southern sky. Pavo, Grus, Phoenix, and Tucana are collectively known as the southern birds. Vela, a constellation in the southern hemisphere, meaning sail of ship in Latin. Our pangs are on Podeba Island, just off the Shackleton Ice Shelf, which is the furthest most eastern part of the continent, about halfway down the coast. Podeba Island is real, and it means victory in Russian. It is formed by the calving of an iceberg over time, and it disappears and reforms every decade or so.